This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Forging Divinity, The War of Broken Mirrors, Book 1, written by Andrew Rowe, performed by Nick Podell. Chapter 1. A Misplaced Weapon of Legend. Talion's jail cell was surprisingly well furnished. A table of lacquered cedar encompassed much of the center, topped with books, scrolls, and an ostentatious gold-framed mirror. A padded chair sat beside it, unattended, much like the four-posted bed near to the barred window. None of these luxuries were accessible from the position where the dark-haired man was chained to the darkest, coldest wall. At first, Talion had guessed that the fine trappings were intended to be a temptation. Perhaps the intent was to imply that cooperation would lead to the reward of a more comfortable imprisonment. Disturbingly, when the questions had come, no such reward was offered. Now he suspected that his captor simply had a demented sense of irony. His suspicions were supported by the sound of knocking upon the chamber's heavy iron-lined door.
"Maybe the headsman will ask me politely before bringing down the axe."
"Come in," Talion said, a smirk stretching across his lips. The sound of a key turning in the lock was jarring. Perhaps some part of him had forgotten that the door was locked. After all, such a measure was largely superfluous given the extent to which the chains bound his body. He was clothed in them, which was perhaps reassuring, as he was clothed in little else. As the door opened, an unfamiliar figure stepped into the privacy of his cage. She wore thin spectacles over a freckled face, her hair, the red-orange of firelight, constrained into a single neat bun. Her loose violet robes, cinched at the waist by a scabbarded belt, emphasized the slenderness of her frame. At a glance, she looked younger than he, perhaps only 20 years of age.
"Interesting," Talion considered. "She is the first female they've sent to see me. Perhaps they think I'll respond better to more delicate persuasion, since force has proven worthless."
After a moment of consideration, he reassessed that idea.
"No, the violet robes mean she's more than likely a sorceress."
He noted 3 silver pins on the collar of her robe, each with the stylized insignia of a spear etched into their surface.
3 pins means she's pretty high-ranking, assuming they use a similar ranking system to the one at home. She's less likely here to seduce, more likely here to try to wrest secrets directly from my mind."
The young woman looked him over for a moment, grimaced, and turned to close the door behind her. He didn't see a key in her hand, nor did he hear the sound of someone else relocking the door from the outside. For an instant, it seemed almost an opportunity. But common sense told him that the woman would be ready for any attempt he made at escape.
"Be patient," he told himself. "You can probably talk your way out of this. It hasn't even been a day yet."
The sorceress reached upward with her left hand, straightened her glasses, and spoke in a clear tone.
"I've been told that you have not been cooperative."
Talion quirked his left eyebrow.
"Hard to do that when no one has told me what I've been accused of."
"You have committed an act of blasphemy against the noble gods of Orlan."
The woman began to pace around the room as she spoke, wearing a disinterested expression.
"I'm Lydia Scryer, court sorceress. I have been sent here to provide you with legal advice and to gather details about the incident."
"You can call me Talion. I'm surprised to hear that I'm being offered any sort of representation," Talion said dubiously, offering her the same name he had given to the other guards. She glanced toward him at the sound of his name, pursing her lips. After a moment, she shook her head in a dismissive motion.
"I may not have been clear. I am not an attorney. My job is to ensure that a confession is extracted from you in a timely fashion."
"Ah, that's much clearer," Talion replied, a hint of disappointment penetrating through his attempt at cynicism.
"Before we continue our discussion, I must perform a cursory examination," the sorceress continued.
She approached him without hesitation, and though Talion felt an urge to stretch forward to test her response, he kept that impulse at bay. Lydia came to within arm's reach of him, a mistake from his perspective, but he did not yet know her own capabilities. His eyes scanned her for any weapons beyond the obvious sword at her side, but found none. The weapon did not frighten him, but her unknown sorcery could pose a threat.
"Dominion of knowledge, I invoke you,"
the woman began, reaching out to touch Talion's arm. His jaw clenched in response, but he made no move to intervene. Lashing out at the sorceress was unlikely to earn him anything other than harsher treatment and more impediments to his attempts to escape. There was no tangible sensation as the spell took effect. No flash of light, no hiss of sound. He felt only the warmth of her fingers pressing against his bicep. In truth, he had no way of knowing if any spell had been cast at all. Knowledge sorcery sounded relatively innocuous, but Talion knew from experience that it could be utilized to devastating effect. He had no talent for the Dominion himself, but his adoptive mother had been an expert. She had taught him that the Dominion of Knowledge could identify weaknesses or fears, even peer into recent memories. He had no defense against it. Simply thinking about other subjects would provide no distraction, and any effort to close his mind entirely would be obvious to the sorceress. Lydia's incantation gave little hint as to what information she was divining. She closed her eyes, seemingly concentrating. After a moment, he realized that her eyes were moving rapidly beneath their lids, almost as if she was dreaming. "That's sort of creepy. Can she learn my goals from a simple touch and a few hastily spoken words? Can she reach into my memories?" The woman withdrew her hand a few moments later, her expression grim. The sorceress folded her arms across her chest, the fingers of her right hand dancing dangerously close to the hilt of a sheathed saber. Her eyes narrowed, scrutinizing something, or perhaps sorting through whatever information she had just harvested from his mind.
"You are a metal sorcerer," she said matter-of-factly, "though your connection with the Dominion is distinct from others I have analyzed in the past."
Talion nodded once. He felt the muscles in his shoulders tense. If she can identify Dominions, that might pose some problems. The young woman's hand moved away from the hilt of her sword, allowing Talion to take a breath of relief.
"If you cooperate, I may be able to answer some of your questions. Demonstrate your ability to use the Dominion of Metal."
A daring request, he considered, and a potential trap. Still, I have little choice. Talion had no need for words. His eyes sealed themselves shut, though in truth, such a step was hardly necessary. He could already sense each piece of metal roughly abrading his bare skin, and with a minimal amount of effort, he could extend that sense further into the interlocking rings. It would have been a simple thing to make a subtle change, weakening the iron bonds at the point where they met with the larger iron rings embedded into the wall. Talion thrived on complexity. He sought out the weakest points in each link, formulating a map in his mind that highlighted each of these flaws. "Degrade," he told the chains, focusing his mind on key locations in the web of metal that enshrouded his form. As he compelled the metal, Talion stretched his arms outward. There was only the faintest hint of resistance as each piece of metal tore apart, his silent spell expanding existing weaknesses even as he exploited them. The motion may have looked to an outsider as if he was tearing through the bonds using brute force. In reality, nothing could have been further from the truth. The Dominion of Metal performed feats that his arms could have never achieved. The chains, shattered by a casual motion and an unspoken word, clattered noisily to the floor. To her credit, Lydia hardly blinked. Free of the metal, Talion was suddenly aware that he wore nothing beyond his underclothes. He stretched, yawning intentionally, but the effort had drained him more than his performance confessed. Using any form of sorcery had a cost on the body. Using flame sorcery would steal his body heat, and he had heard that using water sorcery would consume water from the blood. Metal sorcery was a more obscure art, and the effects on the body abstruse. Whenever he overused the dominion of metal, he found himself exhausted and profoundly hungry, but he suspected those were side effects of a cause he did not understand. After a moment of pause, Lydia said quietly,
"I was hoping for something subtler. Someone could have heard that."
Talion shrugged casually, trying to hide his disappointment in Lydia's uninspired reply. "You could have been clearer. In any case, I doubt anyone heard me. Nothing happened last time." Lydia took a step back, her face betraying a hint of surprise for the first time.
"You've broken the chains before?"
"Of course." Talion reclined against the wall, a crooked smirk favoring the right side of his mouth. "Putting them back on is significantly more difficult, but I would have been insane not to test my most effective method of escape." The sorceress reached up and pushed her glasses back further on her nose.
"You could have been caught."
Talion held his hands up in a gesture of helplessness. "To be fair, I was already caught. Imprisoning me further would be redundant, would it not?" He paused a moment, and then noted, "That rhymed, I think." Lydia folded her arms again and tilted her head slightly to the side.
"If you could have escaped at any time, why are you still here?"
"Courtesy?" he tried.
She shook her head. "Unlikely. You must have some incentive to remain here. Perhaps you are biding your time, waiting for an ally to rescue you?"
He sighed, holding his hands up in a gesture of helplessness. "She thinks I'm some kind of criminal mastermind. That's kind of flattering, but I should probably set her straight. And if honesty doesn't get me anywhere, I can always fight my way out if I have to." "Nothing like that. I'm here alone, not as part of any sort of grand conspiracy." He paused, knowing this conversation could quickly maneuver a saber into his body. "A few reasons I haven't broken out. First, the last guy who visited me, Verudin, I think, was pretty friendly. I was hoping I could eventually talk my way out. Second, even if I could get out of this room easily enough, I'd have to harm innocent people to get all the way out. Third, I don't know where any of my belongings are, and I'd really like them back. If I fought my way out, I might never see them again." Lydia furrowed her brow, silent for several long moments.
"What is your connection to the gods of the Taos Pantheon?"
Talion briefly glanced downward at the chains piled around his feet. "I'd love to have a good answer to that myself."
"And the sword you carried into the city?"
Lydia asked, her right hand drifting toward her own weapon as she spoke. He did not tense for an attack. Her motion looked incidental, not hostile. Talion's thoughts went to his missing weapon, the object that had presumably been the cause of his arrest.
"This sword is your inheritance," his adoptive mother had told him. "The paladins of Taos may cause you trouble. They consider it sacred. They call it the Talion, the sword that gives."
He had learned later that the full name of the sword was Sekes Talion, and he had taken the latter word as his own title and surname. He knew some people would find that arrogant, but humility had never been his greatest strength. The weapon's winged hilt and jeweled pommel were quite distinctive, especially given that the paladins of Taos wore tabards with the sword featured prominently upon it. "Nothing but trouble, I assure you," he stretched again, and then began to rub at the spots on his arms where the chains had abused his skin the most severely. Fortunately, the chafing was his only current injury. His arrest had been smooth and methodical once he had surrendered his sword, and his captors had not resorted to physical torture. If they had treated him poorly, he would have attempted an escape immediately. "I had no idea that the symbols of the Taos Pantheon were illegal here." The young woman stood, unfaltering, seeming to carefully measure each word.
"How did you acquire the weapon?"
"I was found with it as a child," he explained, still nursing his bruised flesh. "My parents, that is, the people who took me in, assured me that it was my birthright. Seems less than plausible, really, but I have thus far failed to find a more satisfactory explanation. Would you happen to have any ideas?"
"Several,"
she said simply. Talion assumed she was bluffing, but her tone didn't give anything away.
What is your business in Orlan?
Talion pressed his hands against his back, and then flexed backward, applying pressure with his hands. He felt a familiar crack along his spine, and his muscles began to relax.
I was told to meet someone here. Eric Taran.
Lydia tilted her head downward and leaned forward toward him, a gesture that was somehow more intimidating than the threat of her blade. In spite of her delicate frame, her green eyes burned with dangerous intensity.
The scholar,
she said more than asked. He nodded, appraising her as he did so. Her stance was not well suited toward initiating combat, but the tightness of her jaw showed the potential for violence. He knew nothing of her capabilities, save that she claimed to be a sorceress. Her spell could have been faked, but given that her assessment afterward had been accurate, it seemed more plausible that it had been real. He was not concerned with her weapon, but antagonizing a sorceress while he was unarmed was an unwise prospect.
I was given a note to deliver to him, but it was confiscated along with my sword and supplies.
Effective, he considered. The combination of my limited knowledge of her sorceress capabilities and her threatening body language is making me far more nervous than the guards did. As a result, I'm talking more to her than I did to them. She might not have any offensive sorcery at all, but she doesn't think I'll call her bluff.
Don't move,
she instructed him, unfolding her arms. Talion waited quietly as she reached down to her sword belt and unfastened it, slowly lowering it to the floor. She bent her knees carefully as she let it down, never letting her gaze leave him. Her gaze glowed with distrust. After removing the belt, which carried both a scabbarded blade and a large pouch on the opposite end, she grabbed the bottom of her violet robes and began to lift them off of her body. Talion found himself at a loss for words, which was a remarkably rare event. As Lydia removed her robes, it became apparent that the sorceress's motives had nothing to do with seduction. Beneath the violet cloth, he discovered a second, identical robe. He found that both comical and somewhat disappointing. As she concluded pulling the robe over her head, she cast it toward him. He caught it deftly, his expression perplexed. Lydia reached down and hastily donned her belt, her eyes only briefly abandoning him this time. Talion examined the soft fabric in his hand for a moment, momentarily perplexed.
Put it on,
she commanded, adjusting her belt with her lips flattened in a self-conscious expression. Talion quirked a brow but wordlessly complied. The inside of the robe was warm from Lydia's body heat. It had fit her loosely, which allowed for just enough room for his arms to fit inside the sleeves without tearing them off. After a moment of confusion at the presence of a protruding bit of cloth in front of his face, Talion realized he had put the robe on backwards. The swordsman slipped his arms out of the sleeves, turned it around, and settled into the garment. Lydia shook her head silently, opening a pouch on her waist without shifting her eyes.
You will put this on and follow me. Once we leave this chamber, do not speak unless you are addressed directly, or if I prompt you to do so. If you need to speak, speak in a deep, monotone voice. You are to call yourself Istvan, a court sorcerer in service of Queen Regent Tylan,
she instructed him, digging through the pouch. Lydia removed a featureless white leather mask, unfolded it, and tossed it at him. It didn't make it quite far enough, so he lunged forward to catch it, bringing himself a couple steps closer to Lydia in the process. She stepped back immediately, her hand again flashing to the hilt of her weapon. Good instincts, he considered. He smiled warmly and nodded to her, finding the leather strap on the back of the mask that he would need to use to fasten it into place. The mask smelled like freshly dyed leather, which meant it most likely hadn't been worn much or at all. He knew from experience that leather masks tended to collect sweat quickly, and the smell of a well-used mask was very obvious.
Keep your hands in the pockets of your robes, Lydia instructed. Istvan's skin is much darker than yours.
Are you rescuing me, or are you just capturing me a second time for a different faction? He inquired, donning the mask. She hadn't asked him to put the hood on to cover his hair, but he did so instinctively.
You may assume I am doing at least one of those things, she replied coolly.
May I ask why? He asked, cracking his knuckles unconsciously.
You can ask, she said, adjusting her glasses. But you won't get any answers until we're clear of this place. If things go poorly, I will need to let you be recaptured, and I can't risk telling you much.
I understand, he replied, disappointed. No, he said, deepening his voice. Does this sound like Istvan?
Her lips twisted slightly in consideration.
Too deep, actually. That sounded pretentious.
Talion sighed, lowering his gaze in disappointment. He liked his malevolent, monotone sorcerer voice.
Very well, he said, making a second effort. I must insist that we retrieve my sword before leaving.
That was a better impression.
She paused.
Your sword? That won't be possible.
He shook his head, continuing to speak in his Istvan voice.
I won't be leaving with you, then. I can't take the risk that the weapon will be transported to a location I can't reach after I leave.
Who is to say it hasn't been already? She asked, flexing her fingers. Never mind. I know where it is, she added in a frustrated tone. You will follow my instructions exactly. No exceptions. Understood?
He nodded gratefully.
Let us go, then, Lydia said, turning toward the door.
Wait, he replied. One moment.
Lydia spun back around, folding her arms and glaring at Talion. He waved his hands in front of him, trying to defuse her.
My lack of shoes is obvious, since the robe is short on me. Just give me a moment.
Lydia regained her composure in an instant, reaching up to straighten her glasses again.
Very well.
Talion slipped over to the bed, casting off the heavy blanket atop it and finding a thin sheet beneath. He was loath to damage a part of such a comfortable bed, but the necessity was pressing. He grasped the corner of one of the sheets and pulled it free, then began to tear the sheet into strips. The cloth was surprisingly resistant, but after a minute or so of effort, he managed to pull away a few pieces. Talion wrapped his feet and ankles in the cloth, layering it as heavily as possible, and then, stepping over to the pile of chains on the floor, he reached down, grabbing a handful of rings and concentrated. Flatten, he told them. The rings of metal shifted in his hand, merging together into a single thin, malleable sheet. He wrapped the piece around his right ankle, folding it so the metal overlapped itself.
Merge,
he told the iron, fusing the ends together, forging a thin metal cylinder around his lower leg. He repeated the process with his opposite leg, creating a similar metal casing. Finally, he picked up a third handful of rings and flattened them around his left arm. Feeling the weight of the sorcery on his body, he stopped there, turning to Lydia.
Istvan is a name from the Terrasguard region. This might look like their style of training without boots. Maybe.
Lydia's eyes narrowed, but she nodded thoughtfully.
Sabatons might have been better, she offered.
Too complex for me to make under these conditions, he explained.
He intentionally avoided saying that he would have had a hard time making something that complex under any conditions.
Even real greaves would be too difficult. These are just flat sheets of metal. They won't offer much real protection, but they look like armor.
It will do, she conceded. We need to go.
Talion nodded and followed as Lydia turned and opened the door. Lydia led the way into a carpeted hallway. Not a single guard stood outside the room, leaving Talion feeling oddly disappointed by the lack of security. He had envisioned dozens of guards prowling the halls, specifically dedicated to preventing his escape. Fighting such a large group would be difficult, especially without killing anyone, but he had enjoyed the idea of the challenge. The sorceress pulled the door shut with her left hand, whispering as she held her right hand open.
Dominion of Protection, form the key to this door.
A shimmering glow enveloped Lydia's right hand, and she moved it toward the lock, turning her hand. Talion heard the familiar shifting of tumblers and the click of the lock. Clever trick. I've never seen protection sorcery used like that before. I suppose that means she doesn't have the real key.
Lydia strode with purpose toward a stairway on the right.
Talion followed awkwardly behind, his fabricated greaves proving even less hospitable for his skin than the chains had been.
I really shouldn't make anything to wear in the future without practice, he considered. Apparently my legs aren't perfectly cylindrical. Who knew?
He considered pausing to try to adjust the dimensions of the greaves, but he decided that the cost on his body from performing additional sorcery was not worth the comfort. He was already starting to feel lightheaded from using his previous spells. As Lydia continued to guide Talion, they made their way up two flights of stairs. He held his head high, confidently, like he imagined a sorcerer who likes to wear a mask might do. It wasn't all that different from how he was used to behaving in a courtly setting anyway. They passed a few people in the halls, a couple of people in servants' garb, and a single patrolling guard. No one paid them any significant attention. The guard actually gave him a salute, to which he nodded silently in reply. As they walked, Talion observed the trappings on the walls. There were tapestries, paintings, and even mounted weapons and armor. The paintings were in a style he wasn't familiar with, favoring colorful landscapes that didn't seem quite real. He wondered briefly who might have painted them, but a glance at the weapons jarred him back into the moment. If any guards catch on to us, I can grab one of those decorative weapons, fix the balance on it, and fight my way to where my sword is being held, he considered. If he had been more proficient at Dominion sorcery, he could have called raw material in the shape of a weapon directly from the Dominion of Metal. His manipulation of metal was a type of core sorcery, which allowed him to manipulate the properties of metal objects that he was in contact with. Using core sorcery, Talion could freely shift the distribution of the material within the metal, allowing him to sharpen edges or alter the weight in favorable ways. With greater effort, he had discovered that he could change some of the characteristics of the metal by commanding it to take on properties of a different type of metal. But this did not extend to appearance, which prevented him from changing iron to gold and making a fortune. He suspected that altering the inherent properties of the metal required drawing from his own body's dominions to make the alteration, but he had never found anyone who could teach him more about metal sorceress theory. Metal was a relatively obscure dominion, and core sorcery was not taught as widely as dominion sorcery. Learning how to conjure or manipulate each dominion was a unique challenge, and thus far, Talion had only managed to demonstrate any degree of control over two dominions. Talion glanced at Lydia, who was walking with a similar air of superiority to his own. I'm sure she doesn't wear an extra pair of robes and carry a duplicate of this Istvan's mask everywhere. She planned to rescue me from the outset, or at least considered it. Either that, or this is all part of some kind of extremely complicated trap. The swordsman grinned at the idea of someone setting up a convoluted trap for him. It seemed a ridiculous notion, given how he had peacefully surrendered, but anything was possible. They reached a large wooden door without passing more than a half dozen people. He contemplated the possibility that Lydia had timed the rescue during a lull in palace activity, after most people had gone to sleep, perhaps, or during some important meeting. It should be in here, Lydia said vaguely, indicating the door with a gesture. She reached down and turned the knob tentatively. The door was apparently unlocked, and it began to slide open. A single figure stood inside, examining Talion's sheathed blade. He stood behind a wooden desk littered with weapons, his body clad in robes, and his face concealed behind a familiar mask. Familiar in that it was identical to the one Talion was wearing. Istvan. Great. Definitely a trap. Talion improvised. Surging forward, he shook his left wrist free of the robe, revealing his makeshift plate bracer. Sharpen,
he told it, creating a thin blade that protruded from the metal cylinder. His initial plan was to grab Lydia from behind and hold the blade to her throat, holding her hostage against the real Istvan. For perhaps the first time in his life, Talion moved too slowly. Istvan raised a single hand and thrust it toward Talion.
"Ignite," he said simply,
a surge of burning light issuing forth from his hand. Lydia stepped sideways, directly into the path of the blast. Talion froze in place as the burst of sorcerous power slammed into the red-haired woman's body. He had seen a similar spell before, and he had seen it kill with ruthless efficiency. Lydia recoiled from the assault, nearly stepping into Talion. He caught her as she staggered, ashamed of his aborted effort to hold her hostage, and observed as smoke rose from the front of her body. His eyes shifted downward for just an instant, registering that a circular section of her robe a few inches in diameter had been incinerated, but her flesh looked unaffected. Lydia shook free from his grasp and lunged forward, while her attacker dropped Talion's weapon and retreated in apparent surprise.
"Looks like she's helping me after all."
Talion grasped the metal encasing his left wrist, focusing for an instant.
"Unfold,"
he told it, causing the seam that held the cylinder together to separate.
"Ball,"
he continued, reshaping the metal into a tiny sphere. Istvan grabbed a dagger from a nearby table and hurled it at Lydia as she advanced. Talion's metal ball intercepted the dagger in mid-flight, sending both weapons to the floor. Lydia didn't spare a glance back at Talion as she advanced, her right hand sitting menacingly on the hilt of her weapon. Lydia's masked opponent pulled a naked longsword from a nearby table, holding it in front of him defensively.
"I suspected we had a traitor among us. I didn't think it'd be you, Lydia."
Talion winced. His earlier impression of the man hadn't been very good. The red-haired woman bent her forward knee as she approached the range of Istvan's longsword, keeping her weapon in the sheath. Talion had never seen such an impractical stance, and he wasn't ready to watch his rescuer be butchered. Talion followed behind her, rushing to the table that contained his own weapon, among others. Istvan raised his longsword and swung it downward heavily, attempting to utilize his reach advantage. Lydia's cut came diagonally upward, not aimed at her opponent's torso or weapon, but at her attacker's wrist. She twisted the blade at the last instant, slapping his arm with the flat of the blade rather than the edge. The jarring force of the strike sent Istvan's own attack awry and forced him to take another step backward, directly into a chair. To his credit, Istvan both retained his grip on the weapon and his balance, growling audibly as he kicked the chair aside. Lydia flourished her blade silently, pointing it directly at Istvan's chest. Talion snatched up a random sword from the table, not daring to draw his own weapon in a place like this. The risks were too great. Before Talion could move to flank their opponent, Istvan jabbed his palm in Talion's direction.
"Burn,"
the man said viciously, a flickering sphere of orange flame surging in Talion's direction. Lydia moved to intercept the spell, but the table blocked her path. This time, however, Talion was ready. Talion's blade flashed twice.
"Disperse,"
he told the flame as it met with iron, and the incendiary globe obeyed his command. Flame was the second of the two dominions he could shape using core sorcery, but his mastery over it was feeble by comparison. Rather than setting him aflame, the ball split further apart each time his weapon struck, washing harmlessly over him in a wave of warmth. Istvan lashed out at Lydia again with a slash aimed at her midsection. Lydia caught the horizontal strike on her hilt and pushed his sword toward the floor, stepping in and tapping him on the face with her offhand.
"Sleep,"
she said. Istvan collapsed unceremoniously, colliding with the chair and knocking it over as he fell.
"Effective,"
Talion mused, staring at Lydia and furrowing his brow.
"Either thought or dream sorcery," he considered, "both extremely difficult to perform, both among the most dangerous types of sorcery to fight against."
"Efficient," she replied. She leaned down to Istvan, pressing a hand to his forehead again. "Dominion of knowledge, shatter his last memories into fragments," she said. There was no visible effect. Afterward, she leaned down further and whispered another phrase in the downed sorcerer's ear.
"Memory erasure? I was led to believe that was impossible,"
Talion considered. He said nothing.
Either the woman in front of him was proficient in a type of sorcery he was unfamiliar with, or she was trying to trick him into thinking she could do something that she couldn't. In the latter case, and possibly the former, he was better off pretending he believed her.
Lydia stood up and gave him an incredulous look.
"Did you bisect his fireball?"
"No,"
Talion replied in his ominous, emulated sorcerer tone.
"I cut it into quarters. Halves might still have hurt."
Lydia quirked her eyebrow.
"You're going to have to tell me how you did that later."
"Trade secret," he replied, grinning broadly.
Without any further hesitation, Talion abandoned the ordinary blade he had acquired and retrieved his own sword from the table. The ornate weapon was still in its unique scabbard, and that scabbard was still on his belt. He fastened the belt on his waist, immediately feeling a sense of comfort at the presence of the weapon that had accompanied him through every memory he possessed. Lydia glanced at the sword, narrowing her eyes.
"We need to wrap that up in a bundle of cloth or something. It's too obvious," she explained.
Talion nodded. The sword was about as conspicuous as any weapon could be. The hilt consisted of a pair of silver wings, outstretched, as if in flight. Between the wings sat a single sapphire, glowing perpetually with sorcerous light. The hilt held a similar, larger sapphire, grasped within four claw-like prongs. The blade, once unsheathed, was even more distinctive.
"Ordinary,"
he told the sword with a pang of regret. He found his eyes momentarily closing as the spell drew from him, and he shook his head to dismiss the feeling of exhaustion. When his eyes reopened, the weapon's guard had been replaced by a simple cross. The pommel appeared to be a ball of metal.
"What have you done?"
Lydia asked, her voice tinged with an unfamiliar note of panic.
"Nothing of significance,"
Talion replied, calmly, raising an eyebrow at her outburst.
"I simply reshaped the metal, covering the gems."
"That is a sacred weapon,"
Lydia said desperately, wringing her hands in the air.
"Assuming, of course, that it isn't a counterfeit,"
she added in a more typical analytical tone.
"It is most certainly genuine," Talion replied with a chuckle. "What's the problem? I thought you were a Donian, not a Taos follower. Why would you care?"
"Your observations do you credit, but your assumptions are flawed. We need to leave,"
Lydia insisted vehemently.
"And then we have a talk. A long talk,"
she assured him, taking an audible breath.
"By all means,"
Talion said, adjusting the familiar sword on his waist.
"Lead the way."
Chapter 2. A Contemplation of Constant Complications. 12 hours earlier. Lydia woke to the sound of a gentle rapping at her door. This was unusual, as few dared to interrupt the sorceress during the early hours of the morning. It was well known that her work often kept her awake past the rising of the dawnfire. Lydia rolled out of her bed and to her feet, taking her sheathed saber from beneath the sheets along the way. After a moment of debate, she set the weapon beside her dresser and withdrew a set of her uniform robes from within. She didn't like the idea of keeping whoever was at the door waiting long, but appearances were important. Once she had donned her robes, the sorceress retrieved her spectacles from the pages of an open book that sat on the chair next to her bed. She put the glasses on, glanced at the mirror near her dresser, and cringed. Vanity was not among her flaws, but even she could discern that her hair was in dire need of aid. Retrieving her weapon, Lydia strode to the door, carrying the sheathed saber in her offhand rather than belting it on. It was a conscious decision, intended to draw attention to the sword and away from her perilous lack of grooming. She swung the door wide. A young man stood before her,
his demeanor modest, his pose timid. Lydia somehow managed to look downward at him, slanting her eyes, though the man was at least her own height.
Forgive me for the intrusion, sorceress, he began.
At least he knows he's bothering me, she considered. This must be important. Why don't I recognize him?
She quickly noted that he wore a single earring shaped like a harp, the symbol of the queen, on his left ear, that he had a small but noticeable facial scar under his right eye, and that his stance favored his right leg. She found that identifying distinctive characteristics helped her recall individuals more easily, which was useful in her line of work.
Yes? Lydia inquired, lowering her left arm to rest the saber against the ground.
Though the movement was the opposite of hostile, her action would serve to attract even more attention to the weapon's presence.
A meeting of the court's sorcerers has been called, the man explained, standing up a little straighter. For when? She asked.
Right now, he said in an apologetic tone, wincing slightly.
Resh!
She cursed lightly, using a popular expletive that literally meant raw garbage.
All right, I'll be there.
In the cobalt room?
Yes, I'm to take you there.
Lydia scowled, leaning forward just a fraction.
I believe I am more than capable of walking up a flight of stairs on my own.
She felt bad for the lad. She had been a timid youth herself, and intimidating others did not come naturally to her. But her present role, Lydia Scryer, required meeting certain expectations. Lydia Hastings might have been gentle or compassionate, but Lydia Scryer most certainly was not.
Of course, forgive me,
the man replied, folding his right arm across his chest and bowing slightly at the waist before retreating. The gesture was slightly odd. In the local culture, one only bowed using the right arm when addressing a member of the nobility. Perhaps she was being mocked, or this man held the court sorcerers in particularly great awe. She had seen similar behavior before, but most of the palace servants were acclimated to the presence of sorcerers. At the moment, that bit of minutia was too insignificant for Lydia to waste her time on pondering it. She shut her door the instant the messenger departed and rushed to prepare for the meeting.
What could be important enough for a meeting at this hour?
She pondered possibilities. An invasion? An assassination attempt on the queen? Perhaps Adon, the leader of the local gods, had laid down a new edict? The worst possibility occurred to her as well. Her identity could have been discovered. It didn't seem likely, since her head was still firmly attached to her shoulders, but it was possible. After swiftly maneuvering her hair into a workable bun, Lydia belted on her sword and a small leather pouch. She glanced at her writing table, a handful of books stacked atop it near dozens of smaller scrolls and pieces of parchment. When attending a meeting with her fellow sorcerers, she always did her best to be, or at least look, prepared. Her eyes briefly lingered on The Nature of Worlds by Eric Tarin, the first book she had ever owned. It had been a gift from her actual father, not the man she had grown up with thinking was her father, to her mother. Her mother had never taken an interest in it, but Lydia had found the contents fascinating. The tome described the various dominions as physical locations, which the author sometimes called planes, and claimed that inhabitable areas existed on these other planes. The world Lydia lived on was said to reside within the core plane, and it was speculated to be one of many. The term core sorcery, now commonly used among sorcerers, was named in reference to this planar theory. Dismissing her errant thoughts, Lydia retrieved a scroll at random from the pile, knowing it was almost certainly unrelated to the discussion at hand, and headed toward the meeting chamber. As she walked down familiar halls, Lydia pondered the possibilities for the meeting.
They could want us to interview a new potential apprentice, or someone to serve in the Queen's Guard. Sullier might have sent another ambassador since things with the last one didn't go anywhere. Or maybe someone has finally identified the assassins that were discovered in the palace a few months ago.
2 months before, a group of armed men had been found near the chambers of the Crown Prince.
They had been noticed, but most of the men had managed to evade capture. Riala, one of the local gods, had personally interrogated the man who had been captured. Whatever she discovered had caused the prince's coronation to be delayed, and the new date for the crowning ceremony was currently 3 weeks away. Lydia rubbed at her eyes as she approached the door to the meeting room.
Gods, I hate mornings. Maybe I should have sent that hugely conspicuous servant to get me some breakfast.
The Cobalt Room was named after Corrigan Cobalt, one of the city's founders. While most of the rooms in the palace had colorful names, literally in some cases, figuratively in others, the Cobalt Room was utterly plain in appearance. The nondescript gray walls completely lacked adornment, which Lydia had quickly realized was a security measure. Sorcerers tended to find ways to turn mundane objects into tools, and practically any item could hold hidden danger. The lone wooden table in the center showed many years of use, though the chairs around it were plush and comfortable. There were no windows, and the room only had a single entrance.
"Close up the room. We're all here," said Sethridge, one of the three sorcerers seated at the table.
Lydia nodded and shut the door behind her as she entered, moving to take her place in the single vacant seat. Lydia glanced at her colleagues, noting who was present. Sethridge had spoken first, and if his usual behavior patterns held, he would do his best to speak last. He was senior among all those present, having served the Queen Regent for more than 15 years. His face was lined with light wrinkles, not from mirth, but the deep creases of worry. While Sethridge wore three pins on his collar, just as most of the others did, he unofficially functioned as the group's leader and primary organizer. This meeting had most likely been his idea. The majority of the other sorcerers tended to avoid each other unless they needed something specific. Aside from coordinating the sorcerers, Sethridge spent most of his time politicking with the city's nobility. The city's nobles commanded comparatively less influence to what Lydia had seen in Velthrin and other cities. The Queen Regent commanded virtually absolute power, at least in theory. This was, at least in part, because Queen Regent Tylan was also considered one of the four local gods. To Sethridge's left sat Verudin, a younger man with skin bronzed by the dawnfire's rays. With only two pins, he was the lowest ranking of the sorcerers present, but apparently senior enough that whoever organized the meeting wanted him there. Apprentices wore a single pin, and apparently none of them had been invited. Verudin was the only one among them who spoke openly of his past, often telling stories about his father's farm, which he supposedly still visited. Sorcerers from the lower classes were rare, if only because few could afford the education required to hone their skills. Verudin had been fortunate enough to find a wealthy sponsor, though Lydia did not know the details of their arrangement. It must have been a pleasant one, since he wore a smile like a second set of robes. Verudin had a series of bandages wrapped around his right hand. They looked pure white, which meant that they must have been freshly applied.
"Recent injury?"
Lydia noted, filing the information away for later. To Sethridge's right was Morella, a woman Lydia guessed to be a few years older than herself. She was a genius at memory sorcery, one of the most difficult types of sorcery to master. Lydia had long considered Morella for lessons, but they rarely spent any extended time in the same location. Morella's talents made her incredibly potent at finding criminals, and she was frequently utilized for that purpose. Her presence was peculiar, indicating that a crime was most likely involved.
"You heard anything yet?"
Verudin asked Lydia, leaning against the table with both arms. In spite of many years in the Queen Regent's service, he had never learned appropriate courtly manners. Lydia had a soft spot for him. He reminded her of Karras, one of the boys, now men, she supposed, that she had trained with.
"No,"
Lydia replied, shaking her head.
"Almost all of us are here," she considered. "Peculiar."
Lydia had heard that Istvan,
The last of the five full sorcerers in the Queen Regent's service had been assigned to a diplomatic mission outside of the city. She had heard that it had something to do with Prince Byron's upcoming coronation, but she didn't have any details. She presumed it involved attempting to track down the potential assassins that had been discovered near Byron's chambers. Regardless of his agenda, she did not expect to hear from him for weeks.
Odd that the Queen Regent always sends Istvan on long-distance assignments rather than Varudin. I'd think that she'd want Istvan here. He's familiar with multiple types of battle sorcery, and Varudin only knows travel sorcery as far as I know. Maybe she just trusts Istvan more. Varudin is a bit impulsive.
In the many years since Orlan had been freed from Zixian rule, sorcery had retained a degree of mysticism amongst the general populace. For centuries, sorcery had been the tool that was used by the most powerful Zixian nobility to keep their slaves in check. While slavery was illegal in modern Orlan, sorcery was still considered an endeavor reserved for society's elite. Sorcerous training was passed on directly from experienced practitioners to a small number of apprentices. The other major cities on the continent handled sorcery differently. Liadra and Sullir tested children for inherent talent at a young age, drafting them into mandatory training and military service if they demonstrated a significant degree of potential. In Velthrin, sorcery was largely controlled by the burgeoning merchant class, with sorceress academies selling educations of varying degrees of quality to those wealthy enough to afford the privilege. Some degree of elitism remained among the highest degrees of Velthrin's nobility, who proudly attributed their training directly to the city's greatest masters. As a result of these cultural differences, Lydia estimated that the sorcerers in Orlan numbered in the low hundreds, and the three who sat with her now were among the most influential. By contrast, in the city of Velthrin, there were hundreds of sorcerer students in academies, and thousands of trained sorcerers in the city as a whole.
"We have an invasion to plan for," Sethridge said without any hint of emotion, his hands folded in his lap.
Varudin shot Sethridge an uncharacteristic look of dismay.
"We don't know that for certain." "What's this about a potential invasion?"
Lydia asked.
"Those worthless zealots in Velthrin seem to be feeling the itch to expand their territory again."
Sethridge scowled, and Varudin raised his hands defensively in response.
"Leaping at a conclusion there, Sethridge. He doesn't even look like he's from Velthrin."
Varudin leaned back in his chair, shaking his head. Morella ignored Varudin and Sethridge's argument, looking straight to Lydia.
"This morning, the city guard brought in a man for carrying a symbol of the Tales Pantheon."
Lydia nodded, and the two men ceased their banter, turning to listen to Morella's explanation.
"Normally this would be a minor issue. I don't think you've had to deal with any cases like that yet, but we typically don't even arrest people for Tales worship, even though it has been outlawed for over a century. We estimate at least a 50th of the population still worship the older gods, in spite of everything,"
Morella continued. Lydia knew much of that already, though her estimate of Taos worshippers in the city would have been much lower.
"The few arrests that have been made in the past usually result in the culprit apologizing, promising to never worship the old gods again, and being set free after paying a minor fine. This case cannot be so easily dismissed. The man was carrying a sword that resembles the sacred weapon of the Taos religion, realistic enough to appear authentic,"
Morella concluded.
"A replica of the Sacus Talion?"
Lydia's mind hit several possibilities immediately. A wealthy noble that worshipped the Taos Pantheon could have been making a statement, hoping that his trial would reverse the laws against Taos worship. This would be an ineffective tactic, but it was plausible. More likely, a noble had bought the replica in another city, thinking it was a beautiful design and not realizing the significance. Even more likely, however, was that the sword-bearer was sent from the city of Velthrin to provoke the people of Orlan into taking action against him. If Orlan took an overt action against the man, it might be significant enough to convince Velthrin to declare a holy war. Lydia concluded that her colleagues had been discussing the third scenario in her absence.
It couldn't possibly be authentic, could it?
We believe it is possible the sword is authentic, Sethridge declared, leaning back slightly as he spoke.
Lydia considered her actions carefully. Revealing her level of knowledge about the weapon in question would potentially lead toward unraveling one of her best-kept secrets. As such, she decided to keep her inquiries brief and her statements briefer.
Why do you believe it may be authentic?
Lydia asked.
Sethridge unclasped his hands, putting his right on top of the table. One, he said, extending his pointer finger. The man gave no resistance when he was taken in. He claimed confusion and ignorance of the law. I know this may not seem relevant yet, but bear with me. Two, he said, extending his middle finger. He proved extremely reluctant to part with the weapon, far more so than to surrender any other possessions, or to surrender himself into custody. Three, he continued, counting with the next finger. The City Watch members who confiscated the weapon were unable to draw the sword from its sheath. They found no bond, latch, or other mechanism to keep the sword in place. Four, he said, extending his pinky. The man had black hair and blue eyes.
Lydia knew those traits immediately. They were associated with the mortal appearance of Ain Darren, the leader of the Taos Pantheon. She said nothing to give any indication that she understood the significance of this, save perhaps with a blink of her eyes. Neither black hair nor blue eyes were individually uncommon, but they rarely appeared together.
Of course, alchemy can be used to dye hair, Lydia considered. And someone with Rethri blood might exhibit a rare combination of hair and eye colors naturally.
Five, Verudin added, interrupting. We haven't been able to get the Reshing thing out of the scabbard either. It's up in the armory. Maybe you'll have better luck.
Lydia quirked a brow with that.
All of you have tried and failed? I won't go near the thing,
Morella explained.
Verudin tried to teleport the sword out of the scabbard. When he touched it to cast the spell, a flare of blue sparks seared his hand.
Verudin lifted up his right hand with a grimace, displaying the bandages that Lydia had noticed earlier. She crossed that mystery item off her mental checklist, nodding to him.
Has anyone attempted any sort of identification spells on it?
Lydia asked.
It could simply be an ordinary weapon with some sort of protective sorcery on it.
That's part of why we woke you up, Sethridge explained. Verudin and I have no expertise at that sort of sorcery, and Morella won't touch it. Istvan isn't here, so that leaves you. We need information, fast. Chances are we won't get another opportunity to look at it after Muros arrives.
Lydia could not contain her concern at that last statement.
Muros is coming here?
Muros was one of the four local gods. He represented battle, strategy, and protection. Unlike in any other kingdom Lydia had ever heard of, the gods of Orlan took part in the affairs of their land, walking among mortals undisguised. To most, this meant that Orlan's gods cared about their people. To Lydia, it meant several completely different things, not the least of which was that these gods were more than likely not gods at all. Still, they were formidable, and wielded more political power than anyone. She did not relish having to deal with the supposed god of battle for any reason, and this was one of the worst reasons possible. Muros carried the Heartlance, an artifact that served as a symbol of the gods of Orlan. Adon, the leader of the local pantheon, had held the spear until Muros had ascended to the position of god of battle. Any blood drawn by the weapon was said to strengthen the wielder. Faithful of Muros would volunteer to cut their hands on the Heartlance's blade, supposedly contributing to the god's strength. Wounds inflicted by the weapon were rumored to bleed indefinitely, and thus Muros would supposedly bless the wounds of his faithful himself, reversing the artifact's effect and showing his appreciation for their dedication.
How does he know?
Lydia asked, folding her hands in her lap, intentionally mirroring Sethridge's earlier gesture. She frequently modeled her body language after his, as Sethridge was typically considered the leader among them, and any similarity in their behavior would help to cause others to consider her to be of similar importance.
Protocol, Verudin explained.
I sent him a messenger as soon as we ran our first tests and determined the sword was Dominion-bonded. Even if it is not the real Sakis, someone went to the trouble of Dominion-bonding a weapon. That costs, and someone would need a good reason to spend that kind of coin.
Resh. Last I checked, Myros was in Torlan. That's only a